Brian has just switched on his iPod, so this talk is being recorded, so there will be a podcast available along with myriad other representations of this presentation, all available from the URI on the first slide of this presentation. So those of you with wireless access in here can actually follow the presentation, follow some links to other resources that we point to. And in a way, we hope that that kind of illustrates the concepts that we are discussing in this talk, in the way that we're not just talking about the web when it comes to accessibility. My name is David Sloan. I'm from the University of Dundee. My group's the Digital Media Access Group. My colleague here is Brian Kelly from the University of Bath. And together with four other authors, we produced this paper. We drew straws and did various things, and then decided that Brian and I would come and present this talk anyway. So I'll start by talking about what we said last year. We gave a paper at the W4A workshop in Japan last year, where we discussed what we saw was an issue with the sort of idea of web content accessibility guidelines, and what we felt was a kind of a sort of mismatch, a difficulty with the concept of the need to design resources for people with a wide range of needs in a wide range of access environments, using resources for a wide range of reasons, and then trying to boil that down to one set of guidelines, which if you follow, you can reach all those people for all those needs, and if you don't follow them, then you can't. And we thought there was a bit of a, there's a problem here, particularly in terms of interpretation and usage and reference to an interpretation of guidelines. We looked at the achievements and the limitations of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, the wonderful achievements they have had in raising the issue of web accessibility at a political level and also at a technical level. Now we had, from 1999 when these guidelines were published, we had something that could be referred to in policy through standards. We had something that technical authors could look at and develop tools to test conformance with, and we're all very aware of the many studies that have come out that have reported levels of accessibility, many of them based on the results of an automated accessibility testing tool, and the whole merits and shortcomings of those are another talk for another time. But there were also a number of potential and actual difficulties and indeed absurdities in the way that some people used the guidelines, people interpreted the guidelines, particularly in terms of legislation that might mandate conformance with a particular level of conformance with guidelines without thinking about wider issues, without thinking about the context in which a particular resource would be used. And that perception led to a sort of more general philosophy that accessibility equated to guideline conformance, and that also equated to usage of open source technologies, and there was a whole load of more sort of dogmatic or sort of ideological issues that seemed to be bundled in. And this, I'm not suggesting that WCAG actively encouraged those, but the interpretation and the very nature of WCAG for many people meant that there was suddenly this technical definition of accessibility, which was the be-all and end-all of things. And the example that I give of the sort of greatest absurdity I thought that this situation led to was when the Disability Rights Commission commissioned a study of UK websites, and that study was published in 2004. It was not part of the official findings of the study, but in the sort of accompanying output of the study, a number of websites were nominated as having performed well in the research. The research had tested 1,000 home pages and then selected a subset of those websites for testing with disabled people who had a variety of disabilities. And some sites in those tests, in those user tests, performed very well, yet did not conform to even basic levels of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So while these sites were praised as having supported disabled people in achieving the tasks they set out to do, they did not conform to level A or level one of WCAG. So there were people commenting saying the research is flawed, the research is a waste of time because they're recommending these sites that do not conform, completely ignoring the fact that those sites that were being recommended had performed well in user trials. So there was this perception that guideline conformance is what we need to achieve, that's all that matters, and the fact that users can or can't use the site's intended purpose is almost irrelevant. So we, all of us who authored the paper last year and who've authored the paper this year, are involved in some way or another in the UK higher education sector. We either are academics ourselves or work with the community supporting people in developing websites, whether they be institutional websites or departmental websites or e-learning resources, resources used for learning and teaching. And we look to the e-learning sector for a more holistic view of web accessibility and the way that e-learning is used as a way to enhance and supplement learning as opposed to a way of changing traditional learning and making it, putting it all online and forgetting all the good things about more traditional learning objectives or learning methods. With that paper we received a large number of positive comments. Brian has documented some of those on his website, and those of you who have access to this presentation can follow that link to see some of them. So 1 year on from that presentation, where are we? Well, obviously, I guess for every one of you who are interested in web accessibility, we are much, much closer to WCAG 2. I think later on we will hear some more about what WCAG 2 will contain, what its philosophies are, what its aims are, how people can work with it and use it in their work. My opinion of the latest draft or the final draft is looking really, really good, and a lot of the issues that we highlighted in the paper last year have been addressed, are no longer there. A lot of the ambiguities or apparent absurdities or potential areas for confusion have gone, and that's terrific. Another fantastic development has been the introduction of the baseline concept. I'm not sure how many of you have read that documentation, just a show of hands. Just one or two. The baseline concept is effectively acknowledging that guidelines need to be applied in context, and the baseline gives various bodies, whether they be web authors or policymakers or whoever, an opportunity to say, to set a conformance in the context of a sort of assumption of what user agents or what browsing technologies can support, what's a set of technologies that are assumed to be supported. So it's attempting to manage the problem that we're trying, you know, previously we might be trying to work with very, very old legacy browsers which can't do things like identify text boxes without default placeholder text. That may be a familiar phrase to some of you who are aware of the guidelines. Trying to manage that problem where, you know, where do we stop, at what level do we say that sort of until condition has been applied, you have the opportunity to say, well, here are my conditions, here are the assumptions I've made. That does place a responsibility onto those people making those decisions to set an appropriate baseline for the target audience. And from our perspective, it is a very welcome development in terms of acknowledging a level of contextual definition that needs to be required. But we wonder, are we still trying to promote something that's a universally accessible web, which might be assumed to be in existence by somebody who's given a copy of the guidelines? Is it possible, if I follow these guidelines, I can achieve something that's accessible to everyone, everywhere? Or should we be looking more to a sort of more pragmatic and real-world goal of trying to make as accessible as possible to as many as possible of your target audience, information, communication, education, services, entertainment, the things that we are trying to do in everyday life and which the web may allow us to do more easily than other ways. The WAI guidelines sort of revolve around a model which relies not just on websites that conform to appropriate accessibility guidelines, but authoring tools that also conform to appropriate accessibility guidelines that maximise the chances that an author will create accessible content, and user agents, browsing technologies and assistive technologies that also conform to appropriate accessibility guidelines. And this is a very worthwhile and relevant model in that it acknowledges that responsibility cannot be just placed on the author, but is also on the people who create the tools to create stuff and also to access stuff. But it also, by assumption, assumes conformant users. It assumes that people will be choosing conformant authoring tools and conformant browsing technologies, which is a big problem when it's acknowledged in WAI documentation that no such browser exists at present. We do hope that changes, but it is an issue. And even if one did exist, the sort of current pattern is that it's the geeks who are aware of conformant user agents. It's the geeks who are aware of extensions and tools that you can add to browsers to make up for current issues, and I'm sure most of us are aware of the current of the limitations of widely used browsers in terms of the availability and support of web standards, the availability of accessibility features, and this is a real problem where the people who could benefit most are least likely to be aware of such technology. Yet there's a common complaint amongst what Joe Clark refers to as the standardistas, the web standards movement, who also embrace accessibility as part of standards, standard compliance. The user needs to take responsibility. Yes, sure, but how do we get the user to take responsibility? How do we even, in fact, tell the user that they need accessibility solutions? How do we tell the user that their eyesight is at a point where something could be done to improve their browsing experience, or do they sit there and just kind of accept, my eyesight's just deteriorating, I'll maybe have to stop using the web. As I say, there's definitely value in that philosophy, but there are practical shortcomings, and this is something that needs to be acknowledged and discussed. We want to see web accessibility in terms of supporting people at completing tasks, supporting people achieving real-world goals, no matter how frivolous or business critical they might be. And referring to a book by Hugh Baer and Karen Holzblatt, on contextual design, the more you know about your target audience in any kind of technology development project, the more you can design to support them. So effectively, we're moving from a sort of this idea of universal accessibility right back to defining something that suits your target audience for their particular needs, regardless of whether that target audience includes or does not include disabled people or people using different browsers. So what we're talking about today is really how can we use the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines to achieve this goal? How can we build into some kind of standards framework the need to follow best practice in accessible design, but at the same time build in this contextual issue? And that's where Brian is going to take over and carry on this talk. So.
Okay, thanks Dave. So, to summarise, WAI's been a great political success. The underlying principles are now widely accepted, but the WAI model has its limitations, and those were addressed in more details in our paper last year. And one of the great successes of WAI in raising the importance of universal accessibility has led to thinking about different ways in which accessibility can be addressed. So there have been developments in alternative file formats, richer proprietary file formats, developments in operating system accessibility. This is all great. There are benefits in blended approaches to accessibility. And there are also the other groups, other bodies, who might have a different approach to accessibility. So yesterday we heard a paper about the IMS Access for All, which is interesting because within the IMS, they define disability as disability in an e-learning context as a mismatch between the education offered and the needs and the preferences of the learner. Disability is therefore not a personal trait, but an artifact of the relationship between the learner and the learner environment. And that learner environment could be a real-world learner environment. So it's saying it's broader than the web. So it's broader than the issues that, say, Wei may be addressing. And similarly, within the library world, I have a poster which is going up tomorrow about the library OPAC catalogues. So you have a catalogue entry for a book, and then a large print version of the book, and then a cassette reading of the book, and then maybe an MP3 player. And they're all different variants. They're addressing the accessibility, but coming from a real-world approach to the digital world. So that's a related view and a related approach to accessibility, which we need to look at. So one of the things we're looking at is how can we apply the way, the advantages of Wei and WCAG within that broader context. So that's the challenge. So we initially focused on e-learning accessibility because we're from the higher further education environment. So we developed a very much a user-focused approach in which the important aspect was the accessibility of the learner's needs and not necessarily the individual learning resources. So this allowed a blended approach to be developed, and we also recognised the importance of usability. There was always that fuzziness about is that usability or is that accessibility, and to take into account the infrastructure and resource implications as well. So that was the model that we presented about 2 years ago, which was very much thinking, well, we're in a learning environment now. How do we learn? Well, we're actually learning from listening, from proprietary PowerPoint slides, from MP3 files, but we also have chats in the bar, we go to the pub. So this is a blended event. It's not just focusing on those types of technologies. And this reflects our business processes. This is reflect what a university does, what learning is about. So that was our first approach, which was looking at accessibility in a learning environment. So recently we started to build on this, to develop the model. So this is the accessibility within context. So we might have the set of best practices at that middle layer. Best practices for open standards, I spoke about this morning. Best practices for accessibility, much of which will be the WCAG guidelines, but not exclusively the WCAG guidelines, the IMS guidelines as well, usability guidelines, Jacob Nielsen's guidelines. So we can have a whole set of policies about different things which can be placed within the context of usage. And then a contextual view of clients. What does it mean if something doesn't comply with a particular standard? So sometimes there might be penalties, you know, big fines. That's happened with the IBM, famously with the IBM developments of the Olympic Games website several years ago. But perhaps it might be acceptable. You know, there might be times when universal accessibility doesn't work. You might accept that. So within the context, and the context will also have those external factors, legal frameworks, cultural factors, etc., etc. So that's what we've been building. And we think it's important to articulate the approach. So we've said the W3C model, we feel, has limitations. We thought initially, well, we had a jigsaw. We had accessibility, and we had usability, and we had interoperability issues, and we fitted them together. But a jigsaw has a single solution, and we don't believe in a single solution. So what we are looking at is the tangram metaphor in order to facilitate this move away from a checklist approach. And so to encourage developers to think about a diversity of solutions. So the diversity might be applied within an IMS access for all context, or a blended context, a real world context. And so the importance is the focus on the pleasure it provides to the user. Pleasure not in a hedonistic sense, but in it fulfills the user's needs. And this tangram model allows us to take solutions, guidelines, best practices from a variety of different areas. Clearly Wei. But also usability. Jacob Nielsen has great sets of usability guidelines. We can pull those in. Organisational guidelines. Click on the logo and you'll go to the homepage. For different types of users. Dyslexic users. Issues about content and understandable content and plain English campaigns. We can pull in guidelines from those type of areas. The legal factors, the management factors. Interoperability issues, accessibility metadata to provide accessible solutions on the fly. and the mobile web. So yesterday there was some discussions as to whether mobile web accessibility is just the same as web accessibility, or it's different. So if it's different, and there was some talk that, well, mobile phones are kind of different, the usage patterns are different from what we expect, so there might be guidelines from that community. So that's a Tangram model. And one of the big dangers David touched on is this testing. And we're already seeing this. If you follow that link, somebody has started to run tests, sell automated tools which say if things will comply with the BSI PAS 78, which Julie will be talking about later on, even though those guidelines says don't test these things using automated tools. There will be vendors who will want to sell those tools. And there is a role for testing, automated testing. But I think we would agree that's just a little part of it. But the emphasis is on that because it's easy to do. You get a nice Bobby logo or AAA logo and you feel you've done everything. But with our type of approach, we can say, well, there are some little things which are testable, but the important thing is the big whole. And so, to conclude, we think there are parallels with the cathedral and the bazaar analogy for open source versus proprietary software development. So if you reflect on the WAI model and the WCAG guidelines, which came out in 1999, so we've been waiting a long time. So WAI has been very ambitious, been very large scale, but it is slow moving. And there are external dependencies. I understand there are dependencies in the Italian legal system, I think we were saying yesterday, so there are difficulties about slow-moving systems built on slow-moving systems, and it's a single approach. It's based on a single approach as opposed to a diversity of approach. And by definition, it's a web-based approach. So it doesn't even cover other IT accessibility or blended approaches. So it's kind of a cathedral approach to development as opposed to our holistic approach, which seeks to be modular, to say there will be guidelines developed more quickly from different communities, a diversity of approaches. So it's within this we're seeking to apply that contextualization outside of WCAG to say this is how you can use things. And it's interesting, people such as Jacob Nielsen says, I don't claim that people should do 100% of what I do. So it allows developers to say, well, that works. Yeah, there's a pattern of usage which says that's a good thing, but maybe that other bit of advice doesn't work in my context. So we would say, argue the advantages of this bizarre approach to development, which WCAG's 2.0 baseline touches on, but that's very much on a technical view rather than the broader context of usage. And our approach is particularly well suited for the UK legal system, which the legal legislation says organisations must seek to take reasonable measures to ensure that people with disabilities aren't discriminated against unfairly. So I think that's good, because that's technologically neutral. It doesn't care about all the geeky warfare that happens at conferences like this, whether it's the semantic web or web services and the like. And it's backwards and forwards compatible. It doesn't matter if a new set of guidelines come out and the legislation is affected. So it avoids those version control complexities. And all the legislation also covers usability as well as accessibility. So it's a very user-focused legislation, which I would commend to you. So to conclude, well, quite clearly WAI has been provided a valuable starting point, but this is really important. So we do need a much richer underlying model for what we're doing. And that richer model needs to address things outside of the web, a more holistic approach for accessibility. Users don't want accessible web resources. They want accessible experiences. It's bigger than the web. So that web accessibility needs to be placed within that wider context. And the approach we've been taking is to provide that contextualization outside the WAI framework. So, thank you.
Guidelines and being flexible, not sticking to one set of guidelines. From a sustainability point of view, I think this is great, but what about from a design perspective? Wouldn't it be too complex and difficult? And what do you think?
I think it should encourage designers to take the wider approach. There still needs to be the underlying principles that services should be widely accessible, but for designers to perhaps think a bit more widely about the approaches that they can take. There will still need to be this core of best practices, and in the web development area, you know, that's very much the things that we're doing.
Yeah.
But within areas such as cultural websites. So there was an example of a prize-winning cultural resource at the Tate Online, IMAP, which was very much a blended approach. So the target audience were blind users,
yeah.
And it was about the paintings of Picasso and Matisse. So the approach taken was very different from a conventional website with all tags on images and the like. And it was a hybrid approach in which you provided tactile images, tactile resources as well to illustrate the painting styles of those particular painters. So I think a problem with that, here are some simple technical guidelines to use, can mean it can be constraining. We still need those things, but we do need, I think, our designers to think a bit more widely.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, let's thank you, Ron and David. Our next speaker will be Stefan.